This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Human appeal. Alright, so assalamu alaikum everyone. Thank you for coming today. And today we have a very special guest that we know, Abdullah Andalusi, giving a title of Is Sharia Timeless? Now, Abdullah has been involved for many years with giving dawah, talking about Islam, and he must have seen him from different, you know, on channels such as ITV, BBC, giving news and lectures, and obviously he's been, you know, an intellectual activist for time. He's, you know, renowned internationally, speaker, thinker, and everything. He's talked about the existence of God, talked about, you know, the miracle that is the Quran, and obviously about Sharia law, which is why we have him here today. So, you know, without further ado, let's bring him along.
Shall the Islamic greetings of peace. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I'd like to thank the Islamic Society of Cardiff for inviting me, the university, the student union, and all of you for your attendance at this event. And we've obviously just come off after this very sobering message of problems that are happening in the world, refugees, wars, famines, and killing. And this really kind of brings us into the question as to, well, how can we solve these problems? You know, it's very interesting, the technological development of humans today. We can overproduce an abundance of food. We can synthesize chemicals of various natures quite easily, quite efficiently. We have global distribution systems and a planet that can support, without causing pollution, more population than there is on the Earth today. And yet currently we're seeing gross famine. We're seeing, at the same time of this, epidemics of obesity on the same planet. We're seeing areas of peace and we're seeing areas of war. Humans possess within our grasp the capability to solve all these problems without requiring charity donations. So then how comes we're in a situation whereby we need to give donations as individuals because governments and international organizations are not solving these problems or don't want to solve these problems, or in some cases are the cause of these problems? Well, maybe not some cases, in fact, maybe most cases. Now, the question is Sharia timeless? And generally, the argument that you hear today is religious laws, or laws based on religion, or any idea which is metaphysical, it's not materialistic, so any metaphysical idea, is somehow obsolete. It's somehow in the Middle Ages. It can't deal with the modern world today. This is the common narrative that we hear. We hear that in this secular world, we have science, and science can be freely unfettered to investigate and solve problems, unfettered from the shackles of religion. And this is the perspective. And of course, what you're generally taught, well, actually, they're generally taught this in your schools, but you're taught this, unfortunately, via the media, via film, especially Hollywood, is that religion causes retrograde backwardness, causes the dark ages in Europe. And this is the common narrative you hear. Now, many Muslims will generally argue that, well, after looking at our own history, we saw that this wasn't the case with Islam, with the Muslim civilization. It wasn't made retrograde or backward because of religion, because of Islam. Although they tried to make an argument that, one typical argument is actually fallacious, that, for example, around the midpoint of Islamic civilization, you had a scholar called Imam Ghazali, who had refuted all the philosophers, the Greek philosophers, and so on and so forth, and this caused the downfall of the Muslim civilization as it became retrograde, backward, and archaic, or stuck in time, or ultra-traditionalist, which is not the case at all. Anyone who's even familiar with the works of Imam Ghazali, the classical Imam Ghazali, he basically actually helped delineate the boundaries between religion and science. that science should be pursued without speculation onto religion, and religion and religious discourse or theology should be pursued and studied without speculation into the material sciences, because these are two areas that are dealing with, well, different things. Things which are the ghaib, things that you can't see, and things which you can see physically in front of. These are two different areas that humans can study and study differently. And of course, many of the classical thinkers in Islam were both theologians or Islamic scholars, as well as scientists, philosophers, mathematicians, and so on and so forth. You had polymath Islamic scholars. But I'm here to tell you that this idea, before I actually go into the whole Sharia discussion, the idea that religion causes backwardness is wrong even from the European perspective. It's actually false. Religion or Christianity did not cause the Dark Ages, wasn't the cause behind European retrograde backwardness, technologically and so on. In fact, if you look into history, it's actually Christianity that helped revive the West from a backward state. And why is that? Well, let's cycle back in time. I just really want to do this very briefly, because this underpins the idea that religion causes backwardness and that religious laws are stuck in the past. And because you're dealing, and we are in a kind of Western environment, obviously this is Cardiff, it's in the West, it's not in the Middle East or Far East, you will encounter this trope constantly. So you have to be able to deal with it because it's false. So you had, around the 5th century, the collapse of the Roman Empire. Well, actually, no. The collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Latin-speaking part, the Greek-speaking part, the Eastern Roman Empire, it never fell. And you know them by other name. You call them Byzantines, but they weren't Byzantines. They didn't call themselves Byzantines. They called themselves Romans. That's what they called themselves. The capital of Rome wasn't Rome. It was Constantinople. They had moved it to Constantinople before the collapse of the Western Roman Empire. These are general facts. So what you happened is you had all these Germanic tribes. Long story short, you had these Germanic tribes migrating into the Western Roman Empire, into Western Europe. And they were basically taking over Roman land. Roman Empire fell to these Western Germanic barbarians. Taking over it, it collapsed. These people weren't cultured. They weren't sophisticated. They couldn't repair Roman technology that they encountered. So what do you think is going to happen when Western Europe is taken over by all these Germanic barbarians? It falls into a dark ages. That's what happened. The Roman Empire was Christian before it fell, by the way. And the Eastern Roman Empire was still Christian. And was still technologically advanced and progressed. Where do you think Muslims encountered all this Greek knowledge of medicine and astronomy? And so where do you think they got it from? They didn't dig it from the ground. They go, oh, look, these old books on by Plato and Socrates. No, they found it in the academies still being taught in the Eastern Roman Empire. That's where the Muslims found it. It was still being taught in the academies of the Roman Empire or the Eastern Roman Empire, as we, let's say, anachronistically call it today. And what happened was that it was actually the Catholic Church that, let's say, survived the collapse of Rome, that many hundreds of years later, it preached to these Germanic tribes to convert them to Christianity. These were pagans, so they convert them to Christianity. They became Christian over hundreds of years. And when they encountered the Islamic civilization in Al-Andalus, or Iberia, and they took this information, they started to translate, it was the Catholic Church clerics, monks, and priests, and so on, who were translating, because they were the only ones who were really educated to do translation. So they were translating from Arabic into Latin. And then they started to establish the first universities in the West that taught the sciences they got from the Muslim civilization. And this kickstarted the Renaissance around about the 12th century. And for 600 years, the West progressed technologically, changed radically, under non-secular religious governments. In fact, the steam engine was invented 70 years before the first secular liberal government ever arose in the West, in the period we call the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment and the Renaissance are two different epochs. The Renaissance was a technological knowledge renaissance of the West, and the Enlightenment is what they call the development of a new ideology, which we now call secular liberalism. Well, it produced a few different ideas, but secular liberalism is the one that is the most dominant one from the Enlightenment period. And this was an idea that you should have laws which are based on materialistic and secular concerns, and not on concerns of a hereafter or on God or religion. So the West revived technologically and in knowledge and in all aspects without any secular liberal government for 600 years prior to the development of secular liberalism. In fact, secular liberalism, you could say, was a byproduct, an unintentional byproduct and latecomer of the Renaissance, and not the driver and the creator of the Renaissance. So the idea in the West that religion or Christianity causes backwardness and caused backwardness in the West is completely false and arose only in the 19th century, mainly by secular or atheist writers. So one in particular that kind of popularized this was John William Draper, when he wrote a book called The History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science, published 1874, which argued that it was Christianity and religion that is in clash with science and causes retrograde or is an obstacle to science. And of course, you had Andrew Dickinson White, who wrote the book The History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom, 1896. These were the books that popularized the myth that religion is backward and cannot deal with the modern world or cannot deal with technological development. But this is very late these ideas were coming about, which almost redefined history, rewrote history, so we get to this point in time where we all think that the Dark Ages in Europe now was caused by Christianity. Even though, if you truly think about it, any one of you who went to secondary school or at university, anyone study history here? Any history students? Okay, you sir, you were nodding quite a lot throughout that. Yes, so it's no mystery to history students, because in the university or in your school, if you think about it, the teachers never ever told you that. So where did you get the idea from? You got it from TV, from films. That's where it came from popular media. But it's not actually factually correct. And the reason why I mentioned this in a discussion on Sharia is because Sharia, in the Western perspective, will be viewed in the same lens. That religious law, or law based on non-materialistic concerns, which is not related to pure self-interest of the individual, are going to cause a retrograde kind of mentality and can't deal with the modern world. And that's false on a number of levels. But first and foremost, what do we mean by Sharia? Generally, people translate or use the term Sharia law, which is fallacious, because the word Sharia, in its legal meaning in Islam, means law. It generally means law. So when you say Sharia law, never say that, because what you're really saying is law. So kind of sounds like nursery rhyme, law. You don't want to say that. So it's a tautology. Whereas in Islam, if you want to explain it in English language, you can probably say Islamic law for a person who doesn't know about this discussion. So just use the word Islamic law. And the biggest confusion for many people is that Sharia is only dealing with politics. Many people, when you hear the word Sharia, they think it's a political system. It's a complete comprehensive system. So it deals with both, as an individual Muslim, it functions as a personal ethical code, and on a society level, it has aspects to it that deal with political organization and purposing of society. So it has different levels and can be applied at different levels depending on who's doing the applying and what is the scope of your application. Now, people generally ask the question, why do we need religious law when don't all humans agree that it's good to be just, that equality is a good thing, that we should be compassionate, that stealing is wrong, that murder is wrong? Why do we need religious law to tell us that this is wrong? Well, you see, the thing is, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was described as a mercy to mankind, a mercy to the world, in fact. And I used to think about this, in what sense a mercy? Is it just telling us about revelation of the hereafter, about God? Because any person who truly contemplates about reality can come to the idea that God exists and there's only one God without need of revelation. So where is the mercy to the worlds and the mercy that is meant when it describes the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam? And it's truly in the revelation of how to achieve the good, how to achieve justice, how do we define equality, and how do we achieve some kind of equality? What does it look like? See, the thing is, all political systems around the world are based and will claim they are supporting justice, They're pursuing good. They're pursuing a type of equality or compassion, or they're merciful. All legal systems throughout the world, throughout human history, have all said the same thing. You won't find a legal system that supports or says it supports injustice. You will never find that. Every civilization believed that their way of life supports the good. You know, and this is also mentioned in the Quran, that everyone in their own eyes believes that what they're on is the right. You know, Allah will make everyone, think what they are on is the right, in the sense of those who want to be, who want to reject truth. So then how does Islam then achieve justice and goodness? Well, here's the thing. It deals with a very, very complex object. Very sophisticated, very contradictory at times object. And this object is humans. Humans were never born with an instruction manual. And unlike animals, we are very complex in many of our behaviors, because we have both enough, so you could say, an emotion instincts, and we have an intellect. This is akal, or an ability to, if you want to be technical, metacognition, which means that for us, we have become more complex than animals, because for animals might be angry with each other, they might love each other or be sad, but for us, we can be depressed to levels, or melancholic to levels that animals probably couldn't reach that particular kind. We can have concepts of hate. So to actually be happy when we do harm to someone that we have a concept of hate towards, whereas an animal might be threatened, might fight to defend itself, or might be angry at, when this is not an animal, we have a concept of hate. We make plans to discharge these ideas and these drives. And these plans make human society much more complex than a troop of monkeys or gorillas or dolphins or ant colonies, much more complex. So how then do we manage humans? Well, first and foremost, in dealing with the issue, is Sharia timeless? One of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is, have humans changed in 1,400 years? No, actually, I'll do one more. Have humans changed in 5,000 years? Let's put that kind of time scale. If you took a baby today and you put it in the time machine and sent it back into 5,000 years in the past to be adopted by a family 5,000 years in the past, would the baby grow up different to the society that it obviously grows up in, or would it grow up the same as the society it grows up in? What do you think? It would be the same. Likewise, if you was to take a baby from 5,000 years in the past, bring it to the future, or bring it to the present rather, inoculate it, because obviously immune systems have developed immunity to current diseases which are around. Inoculate it and raise it. Will it be any different to the society it grows up in today, or will it be the same society it grows up in today? What do you think? You'd be the same. And here's the issue. Humans haven't changed. And human issues and problems haven't changed. Humans still want love. They still want protection, security. They still want livelihood. They want shelter. They need clothes. They need food. They need to treat illnesses. And 5,000 years ago, they had medicines. Basic. Maybe more basic than today. But they had medicines, or they had treatments for it. And the idea that a society has to help its sick, 5,000 years ago, humans had such mechanisms. Maybe not centralized hospital systems, but they had systems whereby families would look after the sick, or communities in villages or towns or settlements would look after their sick. They had the same problems, and they had similar basic solutions. So I usually kind of put a challenge to the audience now, which is, can you think of any technology that we have today that couldn't be explained to someone 5,000, 3,000, or 2,000 years ago? Would anyone like to take up the challenge? Can you think of any technology today which could not be explained, if you were able to speak the same language, to someone 5,000 years ago, 3,000, 2,000 years ago? Anyone? Make any suggestion. Just up there.
Aeroplanes.
Very good.
Internet.
Okay. Internet is easy to respond, because in the past, humans had either billboards they would have public recitations of poetry to spread messages that were basically trying to be conveyed, or they could give a message to a courier who would take it long distances, or write it down on a piece of parchment, or if you're part of the Hittite civilization, write it down on some very thin stone or clay tablets, and that would be transported distances. You had public proclamations by kings 5,000 years ago. How could they make public proclamation if there wasn't the ability to do so? Of course, they had the ability to make a message popular or well-known. And they had, as I said, you had the town billboards, or in 1,000 years ago, town criers would ring a bell and would announce news. You had the same. As for the plains, which is very good, a very challenging one, I think, in fact, it's the first student has ever mentioned that for all the lectures I've been doing on this. It's very, very good. We'll just explain it. It's transportation. They had transportation where you put wood on top of a river and you could sail on a different medium. You know, you'd be floating above the riverbed. You wouldn't be actually on the riverbed. You'd be floating on it. So you could explain that something that is buoyant and that transports you distances. They could still understand that. Transportation could still be understood. Or camels, horses, donkeys, transportation. It just happens. Technology just enables you to do things physical things that couldn't be done, that would take longer before to do it, and to do things that couldn't be done, but in terms of the physical aspects of it, but they still follow the same basic kind of motivations for why people use the technology for. So medicine today is, yes, we get it in pills, we get it in tablets, we get it in injections. Back then, they would have it either on, they would have it as, soups, or they would make it as terms of herbs that would mix with your food, or just give you herbs, or they would crush it up into drinks. They'd have the same kind of ideas of medicine that we would, more basic perhaps, not as sophisticated, not with as much knowledge as to the details of the material world as we have today, but the same basic issues. If you were to tell someone 5,000 years that we should be feeding the poor, those who can't feed themselves, that same commandment could still be understood 5,000 years later. And in fact, many religions which are that old still have those commands and are still viewed as being relevant because those issues haven't changed. Don't steal doesn't need to be abrogated by modern society. Same-wise, don't commit murder. Is that an old, archaic law? No, of course not. We wouldn't say it for that. Does anyone here study philosophy or what they call political science? Anyone here? Oh, you, sir? You the same, sir? So, a man of all seasons there. Anyone else? No one else studies it? You must be the most cultured person in the room. Well, if you studied in political philosophy or science at Adidas University, I'm assuming?
No, Swansea.
Oh, Swansea, okay. So, no, it's not even from this university, for shame. What are you doing, Cardiff? What do you guys study here? Sorry?
Medicine,
okay. So, sorry, well, here's the thing. When you studied philosophy or even political science, one of the first books that they might have introduced you to are books written by Aristotle, or at least attributed to Aristotle, of course, Plato, discourses, and people also talk about Machiavelli, his books, and so on. Even though these guys were hundreds of years old, and for Plato and Aristotle, you know, thousands, yet they're still viewed as being modern, speaking in a modern way that's accessible by the modern reader, talking about universal problems, universal issues of human existence. That is viewed as modern. Democracy, or Athenian democracy, is 2,500 years old. It's actually 1,000 years older than Islam, or 1,100 years older than Islam, and yet it's viewed as a modern system for political organization society, whereas Islam or the Sharia is typically presented by many media pundits and those who criticize Islam as backward, medieval, and so on and so forth, even though Islam is more modern than democracy. Actually more modern. So when I put this, it's to put into perspective that if humans don't change, then laws, or the basic structures of laws, wouldn't change. Of course, you wouldn't have laws to manage, for example, a barter system, because bartering system doesn't exist anymore. Now we use money. Although that being said, people can exchange goods, which are not money, but I'll sell you my I'll give you my bike if you give me your sofa or something like this. People still do those kind of transactions or barter. But generally speaking, we have this sort of money. And what you see with many legal systems is that when these new technologies are brought in, the legal system has to extend itself to discuss these new technologies. So just look at how, the law of England and Wales dealt with the internet. Right? So it has these cyber laws that deals with issues. Like, for example, in England, it's wrong. It's obviously, you can be sued for slander. And slander was generally taken as, if you insulted someone behind their back, and said something that damaged their reputation, or you wrote a book that was printed or published, which insulted somebody, or at least imputed them something as a fact, something that's not true, that damaged their reputation, you could be sued for libel and slander. Whereas on the internet now, the laws have just adapted to encompass that anything you write on the internet, which also fulfills the criteria of slander and libel, is also equally to be punished under the same rules. Even though the internet is a new invention. Why? Because slandering someone on the internet and slandering someone behind their back or in print is the same thing. As long as the law can understand what this new medium does and how it works, the principle is easy to understand. So then how comes Islam and Islamic law is portrayed in this public discourse as being unable to deal with modern problems? And as many Muslims, we know there is a mechanism to deal with modern issues, which is called ijtihad, which means, it just means exhortation with the legal text to understand the reality of what has arisen, and applying the timeless laws of the Sharia onto a new reality. But you have to work out what this reality is like, what it is, and then how it relates to something that already exists in the Sharia, and then you extend that application onto it. So it works in any legal system. Now, this is very basic, and I don't want to get into particularities of these matters, because I think on a basis, the Sharia is timeless and universal. And of course, we have the human component of understanding the Sharia, which is called fiqh. And fiqh is a means by which, as Muslims, we try to strive to understand what is the Sharia of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Of course, as humans, we are ignorant, we only have limited information at many times, we make mistakes, and so there's a difference between fiqh and Sharia. Sharia is considered by Muslims to be the revealed law of Islam, revealed law of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of God, whereas fiqh is the human attempt to understand the Sharia and to apply it onto current day situations, modern day situations. I'll just give a very basic example. And this is a very simple example. So you had the invention of the automobile. Now, if the Sharia was to understand whether the automobile is something that is a good thing or bad thing, a very basic principle is what does an automobile do? Well, it enables transportation. Its purpose is transportation. Did the Muslims in the past ever use anything for transportation? Well, they did. Horses, camels, ships, sailing ships of that. So then, if the purpose of the car is transportation, and its function is to transport, to displace you physically on this earth, then if horses were allowed for the same reason, or camels or sailing ships for transportation, then the car can easily be incorporated into law. Because the function of the car can be understood by an Islamic scholar from 1,400 years ago. You could explain it. And they could then explain whether it was what we call halal or haram, whether it was allowable or not. And they could understand that, okay, this is just a new version of a horse or a camel or a sailing ship. So in this sense, the Sharia is always timeless. But I want to maybe ask a more basic question. Our real question isn't, is the Sharia timeless? Because this implies that the Sharia has to deal with the modern world. And there's always argument as to, can the Sharia deal with the modern world? And can the Sharia adapt to the modern world? There's always the implicit assumption behind this. But I have a more fundamental question that we should ask. Is the modern world compatible with justice and mercy? That's a better question. No one really asks themselves that question. And we have to ask ourselves that if the Sharia is timeless, and the world is not compatible with justice and mercy, then can the Sharia give guidance in the modern world to solve the problems that humans encounter today? So let's look at some of these issues we see in this so-called enlightened modern world. We see today in the modern world that 62 people own as much wealth as the poorest 50% of mankind. We see that this actually has gotten smaller since 2010, when it was only 388 people that had owned as much wealth as the poorest 50% of mankind, which is now coming up to what? 3.5 billion people, that the poorest half will be half, obviously, of 7 billion. So poorest half will be 3.5 billion, and it's going to reach 8 billion soon. So basically, 3.5 billion people, all the wealth they own equals the amount of only 62 people in presumably the wealthiest countries on this planet. And it's got worse. It's got since before. We also see that the wealth of the poorest half of the world's population has fallen by $1 trillion since 2010. So the poorest half of this planet has seen their wealth drop by $1 trillion since 7 years ago. Just 7 years ago. And this drop has occurred despite the global population increasing by around 400 million people during that period. We also see that globally, the super rich, those who are viewed as the super rich individuals, have as much money stashed as $7.6 trillion in offshore accounts. And if tax was actually charged on the income this wealth generates, it would have created an extra $190 billion per year for every government to use. We also see by research programs that looked into this, including one was a report by the World Institute for Development Economics Research at the United Nations, reported that the richest 1% of adults owned as much as 40% of global assets. So the assets on this earth, 40% of them is owned by just 1% of adults. And this was in the year, just in the year 2000, and now it's 50% of global assets are owned by 1% of the world's population. And this isn't just reflected globally. Also, in the most richest countries, you see the same thing being replicated. In the United States, as of 2010, which means it's got worse now, the top 1% of households owned as much as 35.4% of all privately held wealth. The next 10% owned 77% of all wealth, which leaves only 23% for the bottom 90% of the population. Of the United States of America, currently the world's richest country at the moment. We also see that 15% of American households reported they were not food secure every year. Now, if anyone has ever been to the United States of America, you know that there's an overabundance of food, including high corn syrup, fat content and sugar content foods. And yet, for 15% of the American population to, despite this, still report that they were not secure with their food, is quite serious indeed. And we also say in Britain, it's the same thing. We see that 1%, the top 1% in Britain, have as much wealth as 54% or 54.9% of the population. So five of the richest families in Britain own as much as the poorest 20% of the population. Five families, not 5%, five families own as much as a wealth as the poorest 20% of the population. And these are the kind of problems that we're seeing, including the rise of food banks, the collapse of the NHS, and all this in the midst of discussions, as people are asking, well, who's behind this, what's causing these kind of problems, and it's always blamed on immigrants or people who are foreigners or refugees. Well, the refugees and immigrants aren't that 1% that's owning the majority of the wealth in this country. That 1% are very much indigenous to this country, and yet the media distract you from that to look at blame others who actually have even less wealth than people who are considered to be indigenous here. And this is the kind of problem you get in a system which we call capitalism. You see, the thing is, capitalism, and anyone who studied the base of capitalism from Adam Smith all the way up to Maynard Keynes, The basis of it was actually meant to be freedom and equality and fairness. Fairness. If you have money, if you have property, you should be able to do with your property whatever you wish. Sounds fair on principle. And if someone, if you make an arrangement with someone and they consent to it, then this is fair. If they consent to it, then this arrangement is legally binding if you both voluntarily consented to it. That sounds fair. That sounds totally fair. But what if you're in a society then where the rich will arranged such that money can only is offered to the poor with the expectation that the poor have to pay back that money plus extra, called interest banking, as we know it today, or riba, as the ancestors of 1,400 years ago would understand it, trading of like-for-like commodities with increase. That's what the definition of riba is. So our ancestors would understand what interest banking is today. You wouldn't need to, it's not an idea that is so innovative that our ancestors wouldn't know this. So if you have a society where the rich make money available, and money is easily available, if you agree to the contractual agreement that you have to return that money plus extra. In that such society, what you're going to get is you're going to have the rich, the top tier, lending money to the poor and returning that money back plus extra. Where is the net flow of money going to go? Anyone? It's going to be to the rich. Interest banking. We also see that if you add to that fractional reserve banking, whereby those who are rich can actually lend out 12 times more money than actually exists and still get interest back from that. So the whole process times 12, fractional reserve banking, you're going to have a situation whereby the poor, although no one's forcing poor people or people who are even middle class to take money, but if you don't have the capacity to buy your own house and you want to buy your own house, then you're going to have to take a loan. And here's the thing that most people don't realize. Do you know why the house prices are so expensive? Do you know why there's anyone here? Do you know why they're so expensive? It's just because houses are expensive generally. If any of you has ever have spoken to your great-grandfather, if there's ever lived, or your grandfather who has spoken to his great-grandfather, of course, they generally had houses that they owned. It was normal for humans to live in houses or dwellings that they owned. But in this day and age, it's actually getting rarer and rarer. Such to the point that they call this current generation, generation rent, because it no longer has the hope of being able to buy it's the own houses or dwellings. And why is that? Why does that come about? Well, here's the thing. Because people are willing to spend that amount of money on a house, it keeps the prices up. And people are only able to spend that money because they're given loans that allows them to spend that money. And because these loans are made available, people take use of it, and it keeps the prices artificially inflated. So in a situation, in a society, no one's going to force you to take a mortgage. Yeah, no one's going to force you to take a loan. But guess what? Due to the vagaries of your work, you might become unemployed. You might have problems with oppressive landlords or what have you. And you might want to get house security. Many poor people who have no other realistic option than to take mortgages that in many cases they will never be able to pay off until they're at old age. And when they're at old age, they will, if they've managed to finally pay it off, they'll then have to sell their house again to pay for a retirement home for themselves, because their families will not look after them because of individualism, right? Everyone wants to be free to do their own thing, and family ties become broken down in that situation. It doesn't happen to all old people, but I say this, how many kind of people do you know, just generally in society, that live with their grandparents or live with their parents? In fact, of old age, that is. I'm not referring to those who are 35 years old living in the basement with their mum or dad. I'm referring to those who they have a job, they own a house, they pay rent in that house, and they've decided to look after their parents along with them. Now, many of you come from, let's say, backgrounds which are very traditional. This is normal. It was normal for human society to do this. And nowadays, it's abnormal. People view their parents as a burden, as a weight on their shoulders. And this is the economic system that the belief of you can do with your property as you see fit, and consensual agreements are fair and valid. This is what these two principles have caused in a world that has implemented those principles. I mean, we call it capitalism. Whereas in Islam, it has a different perspective on this matter. Also, the financial derivatives market, stocks and shares and brokerage, where people are basically buying and selling and trading contracts. In Islam, contracts are not viewed as a commodity. So if you can imagine there are economy is like there's two tables. On one table, people are buying and selling commodities. On a second table, they're buying and selling promises or contracts on those commodities, on those who are buying and selling commodities. What you'll get is those in the second table are artificially affecting, inflating or deflating the prices of those on the first table, even though it's not related to any real world issue, really real world driver. So the supply and demand basis, which should determine prices, is artificially interfered with by a parasite market, which is all allowed because people are entering into it voluntarily, freely, it's fine. And people are seeing financial benefit in floating their company on stocks and shares markets to get more money in, but then it's now interfering with their company. It's now interfering with the financial work of their company. And the derivatives market has become so overinflated with money. It's now worth, it's worth $596 trillion. Now, when you consider that the entire derivatives market of the world is $596 trillion, and you look at the world's gross domestic product, which is only $65 trillion, what you get is that the world's GDP is only 10%, or roughly 10%, of the value of the global derivatives market. There is quite literally not enough money on the planet to underwrite all these derivatives if the banks start selling due to running into trouble. Which is why when people realize that the paper money, which is the fiat system, of course, which can be obviously printed at the command of the government, mostly at the behest of, by private banks, such as the Federal Reserve Bank, which is a private bank, it's not a government bank in the United States. It can create this money. When people lose confidence in this money, the entire system collapses. If everyone cashes their money out at the same time, it will still collapse because there's not enough money in the system to pay for all the cash that's there because of the fractional reserve banking where the money is lent out 12 times in the same account. Anyone who studies economics? Okay, so this is not brand new to you. You guys know this, right? You know? All right. This is all the system that has arisen when you had an unfettered and chaotic system arise due to human beings discharging these very basic principles of, well, it seems fair to do with your property as you see fit, and it seems fair that if everyone agrees into a certain contract that they should honor that contract. Here's the situation that occurs. How does the Sharia deal with this? Well, off the bat, the Sharia prohibits interest, prohibits the trading of commodities, like-for-like commodities, with inquiries. Prohibits it straight up. And if you think about it, it's actually quite rational. Why? Because what's the purpose of an economic system? Any one of you economic students want to answer? What is the purpose of an economic system? Put you guys to the test. Sorry? So to maximize product profits, very capitalist of you, sir, but incorrect. Anyone else?
To distribute wealth.
But what is wealth a means to?
Maintaining
the well-being of all inhabitants. Yes, I suppose you could say that.
Allocate resources
efficiently. All right, well, kudos to you, sir. That is correct. The purpose of an economic system is distribution of resources. Why? Because resources have been scattered around this planet in different areas. No one area has access to all the resources that people need. So the purpose of an economic system is so that people can distribute the resources so that everyone gets the resources that they don't have locally and sells that gives their surplus resources to those who need it, not locally. That's the purpose of an economic system rationally, if you think about it. And Islam understands this. So the Quran says God has prohibited interest and allowed trade. Trade is the basis of economic system. Islam also prohibited price fixing, so to allow the supply and demand, the natural mechanism supply and demand to regulate distribution and regulate prices. The economic system in Islam uses money, which is, you could call it a bimetallic system, gold and silver, objects you have to spend resources to get out of the earth. You can't just print it. You can't print it. Therefore, controlling inflation. Of course, people say, well, if you don't have interest, how do you control inflation? Or I say, we don't have interest, and you don't have inflation due to fiat currency. You get rid of both those problems. People see interest rates as a means of controlling inflation or fiat currency. Whereas if you don't have either of those two, you have no problem. And this was a very successful system. And it worked because it was based on what was on natural resources. And most economic systems are based on to some degree on gold and silver reserves in their banks. They need to be based on gold and silver reserves. The US government, or the USA for that matter, it was based on the gold standard up until only very recently, only in the last century. It stopped using the gold standard. All that progress it developed without needing a purely fiat system detached from something that is actually objectively existent, that comes from the ground and costs money to extract. So Islam understands these things and it deals with these issues. But more fundamentally, Islam has a more fundamental solution to the many assumptions that man-made systems come up with. Has any of you economic students heard of what they call the human economic problem? It should be on the first class you ever attended in economics. Yes, you have. What is it? Would you like to get to explain? I made you regret saying you. No, what was it? The human economic problem is the belief that humans have infinite needs or infinite wants and scarce resources. So this is a problem that can never be solved according to the human economic problem as devised by the capitalist system, which is taught to you as just a de facto economic universal challenge. As it was, this idea or this perspective is somehow universal to all people who investigate economics. It isn't. It actually isn't. So, but the solution they devised for it is to maximize production in order for hopefully to try to address the problem, not to solve it because it can never be solved, but to try to address it the best that humans can. That is the idea, maximize production in order to hopefully, through a trickle-down effect, everyone getting the resources that they need. They have blind faith in this idea. Of course, it's fallacious. Why is that? Because humans, first and foremost, those at the top of the pyramid, when the resources come in, their resources expand, they can buy more of these resources, and it just concentrates with them, and only a little bit comes down to the bottom. The idea that once those on the top are fulfilled, you know, like when you see these at some very fancy parties where they put all these glasses into like a pyramid structure and they pour whatever type of dubious drink at the top and it goes to all the glasses. When the top glasses become filled, then the overflow goes to the glasses in the second tier, then the third tier, the fourth tier, and all the glasses get filled, right? That doesn't work because for humans, the capacity of humans or the belly of humans to control, own an infinite amount of resources if they were left up to it is insatiable. As the Prophet Muhammad said, if you were to give the son of Adam a valley filled with gold, they would want a second one. And nothing would fill their belly except dust. Which generally means that they would never be satisfied until they're dead, basically. They'll always be greedy. So if you're hoping that human greed will create a just system, an equitable system, then you're sorely wrong. Whereas Islam views the human economic problem from a completely different angle. It says that humans actually have finite needs. How much shelter do you need to live under, for all of that to be satisfactory? How much clothes do you need? I don't care how many shoes or handbags or jackets or whatever you have, how much do you need to be satisfied as a human to clothe yourself from the cold and to generally have a reasonable selection for different kind of events? You don't need an infinite amount. How much food do you need? I don't care how American you are, you only need a finite amount of food. You don't need an infinite amount of food. So what Islam deals with this is it guarantees the human needs, but when it comes to luxuries like, I don't know, fast cars and plasma screen TVs and what have you, Then let human meritocracy deal with that. Retaining the profit motive. But in communism, it's absolutely everything distributed absolutely equally, which removes the profit motive. What's the point of becoming or spending 7-8 years becoming a doctor when you can be a cashier and earn the same amount of money? All that stress that doctors go through. But why bother? Why bother to improve your work if you're going to get the same money? The communists find it very hard to motivate themselves. They had hoped that humans have a universal desire for justice, and so they would do good and they would excel because of they wanted international justice. They did had a desire for international justice, but without from a purely materialistic perspective, they realized that humans, if they were purely materialist and there was no God, no religion, no hereafter, no reward, no God, then humans aren't motivated to think of other people outside their local family or their local village, town, or what have you. They're not motivated to do good to others they can't see, or to strive every day to the absolute if they get no increase in their circumstances, no benefit to it, at least some physical benefit. Whereas in Islam, it retains a profit motive on the luxuries to generate improvement, to generate a desire amongst people who are more, let's say, materially motivated. Of course, humans, you can't detach your nafs from your intellect. Right? You can be motivated for Sabilillah, but you also have to. If you work hard, you can also get more money to, let's say, gift your kids, gift to your wife, or gift to your husband, or do something good, feed the poor. You can. Money was not viewed as a source of evil, but as a source of good, because you could use it for good things. You could use it to excel. You could use money to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. By investing it, the rich, in order to avoid certain taxes, could lend money out to the poor, and therefore by their money not be taxed because their money has been lent out, and the poor just would pay back the money that they were lent and use that money to develop their industry, their businesses locally. That's just sort of kind of development. Islam implemented a wealth tax, the zakah. And why is it called a wealth tax, not an income tax? Well, here's the thing. An income tax, when you get money, when the rich person gets money, in England, in America, yes, they have to pay sometimes 40 to 50% of the income they get to the government, yes. But with that 50%, when that's left over, they've got it. They put it in their bank, they get guaranteed interest on it, and it never goes down. Never goes down. Whereas, what you saw is they can just gather up more and more and more and more and more wealth. Without no further tax. Once you've paid your income tax, it's yours. No one can tax it anymore. Whereas in Islam, as the Quran says, lest wealth circulate only amongst a small group of you, it implemented the zakah to redistribute wealth from those who are wealthy to those who are poor. 8 categories mentioned in the Quran to which the wealth should be redistributed. Every year, anyone who reaches it, who has above the minimum amount, the nisab amount of wealth, has to pay 2.5% of it every year for the rest of their lives on 8 categories mentioned in the Quran, which include those who are destitute, those who are poor, those who are in debt. Forget bailing out the banks when there's a recession. Bail out the people. Iceland tried that. They let the banks collapse, and instead they bailed out the people and their economy recovered almost overnight. Bail out the people. The wealth, those who have money can't just sit on it now, concentrating wealth. They have to invest it. So now either they invest it, they lend it, or they're going to be paying zakah on it. So imagine a system where everyone, especially certainly the wealthy, all the money they get, they reinvest it back, or they spend it back, or they lend it back, or they pay it back into the system. Imagine the kind of economic progress that can create, and historically did create in the past. And these are just 2 basic examples. There are many, the Islamic economic system is actually very sophisticated. Many people only know these 2 basic things. There's other things, such as, for example, in Islam, a person is not allowed to own public resources. So we know of an example where a gentleman came to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and said, "O Prophet, could you give me this area of land to cultivate?" In Islam, we believe that if there's uncultivated land, if anyone wants it, they can have it, provided they cultivate it. And if they don't, after 3 years, it gets redistributed to someone else who will cultivate it. No point hoarding land that goes unused. Some people were telling me that, just gave one example, that in Pakistan there were many individuals who were very wealthy landowners, who owned huge swathes of land, completely unused. And it could have been used for so much, but it just goes unused because people want to hoard it and keep their land for themselves, and they don't want to spend money on doing anything with that land. In Islam, it will get redistributed to those who are willing to work the land and make produce. But, so there was a hadith where a person went out to the Prophet Muhammad and said, give me this area of land. And so he assigned it. Then someone said to the Prophet, oh Prophet, do you know what you've given this person? An uncounted amount of water. Lots of water. It's a big area of water there. And so the Prophet Muhammad recalled the man and kind of relinquished it off what he had given, the grant off of him. Because you can't own resources of public benefit. So imagine then a modern economic system under an Islamic government, whereby the resources of the land, the natural resources, are not owned by the government for its own personal benefit, to line its own pockets, like you get in many countries in the Muslim world, unfortunately. It's not owned by private corporations who form cartels and agree with each other to raise the prices so that everyone has to pay a high amount for their energy. No, but that all energy is provided to everyone only at cost price. With only increases in pricing, only to invest in making it more efficient than to then make it more cheaper in the long run. Imagine that kind of society where no one owns the public resources, but yet it belongs to everybody. That is what would be provided by in an Islamic economic system. And a system that could generate justice in today's world, that today's world sorely needs. And I'll finish up with another issue. Everyone usually questions the Islamic solution and treatment of crime. And they say, the Islamic solution to crime, many of its punishments, which are corporal punishments, and not prison sentences, they say it's inhumane. Why not have prison sentences? Isn't that the modern way to do, you know, how you do, how a civilized country should do these things? Well, actually, let's look at it. Let's look at what a punishment system does, how effective it is in the modern world. What is the purpose of a penal system? Does anyone like to venture?
Retribution, rehabilitation, and there's another retribution, rehabilitation. I've forgotten the third one.
Okay.
There's three, retribution, rehabilitation, and something else.
Okay, so retribution, rehabilitation. Anyone else? Sorry?
Deterrent.
Deterrent to what? Okay, you've completed each other's sentences there. Twins. So people say, okay, so the punishment system is there to provide a sort of formal source of retribution that is not left to the chaotic whims of individuals to discharge themselves, to rehabilitate people back into society so that those who do break the law can be brought back into society and will be assured that they would stick to the laws of society, and of course to deter people who are not deterred by their conscience or by God, to deter these people from committing the crime in the first place. Well, let's look at how effective the Western system is on that. So let's take the figures we have from the Ministry of Justice. So basically, what they've noticed is in the UK, 50% of people who have been imprisoned, once they are released, will reoffend within the first year of release. And this rises to 74% within the 9 years that they'll be reconvicted. And when I say reconvicted, not that they'll go out and commit a crime after 9 years. No. They'll be caught and convicted of a crime within 9 years. So that means that they've done multiple crimes, but they'll, on average, 74% of them will be reconvicted of and caught and punished for another crime within 9 years of being released. In the US, it's 67% of ex-prisoners will reoffend, and 52% of them will be re-incarcerated within 3 years of being released. It's become so much the norm in the United States, they've turned it into an industry now, where private corporations vie with each other to actually run prisons and control because they're lucrative on public funds, basically. But here's the thing, so it doesn't work. Rehabilitation is not working. The US has the highest prison population in the world. Contemplate that. Because China is the country that has the highest population in the world. And yet America has more prisoners in prison than China does, which is quite significant. So is it working? Is it preventing people from committing crime? Even in England, they reckon that the prisons, Ministry of Justice figures published show that prisons in the UK are up to 98.1% capacity. And in the United States, they have to release prisoners who are on minor felonies, release them early in order to fit those who have committed more major felonies. But also, people haven't considered another angle. Are prisons even humane? Locking humans up into cages, into human zoos, where all they have is each other to fight, to bicker, in some cases to rape, in many cases. Many of you do not want to be in a US prison. Let's just put it like this, some of the well-documented stories that are coming out, well-documented studies that are showing these issues. And in fact, in prisons, people actually then share best practice of how to commit crime. Some people call it, you know, criminal universities, because they share best practice. Of course, how much stock you should put on anyone who's in prison to teach you how to do better crime is a different question, but it certainly is viewed as that, criminal universities. And of course, we don't look at those who suffer the most, I would argue. Those who are left behind, the families who've been deprived of fathers, brothers, sons, mothers, daughters, sisters. What about them who've had their relatives removed from them? They didn't commit any crimes. They didn't break any laws. Yet they are being punished. They have to suffer from being deprived of their loved ones. So in this situation, the Islamic solution is no prisons. Instead, crimes are punished by fines or corporal punishment. Which you might think, oh, that's barbaric. But guess what? In a corporal punishment system, people are returned back to their families the same day. The same day. Unless they've committed capital offences such as murder. But even in that, Islam has something that the Western justice system doesn't have. Mercy. The family of the victim can choose to forgive you. No judge in any country can choose to forgive you. Or no judge in any Western country can. Maybe certain presidents of the United States can, but good luck being forgiven by President Trump. Yeah, but you have to be pardoned. They can pardon you, but you can't be forgiven by a judge. Yet in Islam, the family of the grieved can choose to forgive you. You can plead your case to them if it was a mistake. Well, if it was a mistake, you won't be punished for murder. You'd be punished for, well, you wouldn't be punished. You have to pay, obviously, a very hefty fine if it was accidental. But if it was deliberate murder, you'd have to plead your case with the victim's family for clemency. And the Quran even encourages people to forgive. Forgive and take the blood money, take the compensation, and not actually demand the punishment. Of course, people often say, what about the punishment for theft? What about poor people? Well, what most Muslims don't realize when we debate this matter is that poor people can't be punished for theft in Islam. If someone steals food for themselves or their families or from unsecure locations, or they do a snatch and run even in the street, they're not punished for theft according to levels of corporal punishment. There are lesser levels that they can be punished on. But if a person steals for food to feed their own family, they're not punished. In fact, it becomes a shame on the state for allowing such a person to be so in need he felt he had to steal. In the West, if you steal because you're poor, sure, the judge might have a kind heart and give you a lesser sentence, but they still have to give you a sentence. You're still going to have to be punished. Whereas in Islam, poor people are not punished. Which system do you think then is merciful? Is more merciful? Is more compassionate? Which system do you think is truly a mercy to mankind? So I'd finish off by saying that and there's many more problems in the world. I just picked two out of the many, the plethora of issues and concerns. But see how the Sharia is not a system that is stuck in the Middle Ages, or that the Sharia has to adapt to the modern world. No. Rather, as Muslims, we should say that not only does the Sharia deal with the modern world problems, the Sharia doesn't adapt, it guides in any situation. It guides and gives guidance in any time. Not adapts, it guides. It knows how to guide at any time with the right solutions. So the real question, as I said, brothers, is not whether Islam or the Sharia can deal with the modern world problems. The real question is, does the modern world need the Sharia to provide permanent solutions and effective solutions? And I'd say that it is. Thank you for listening.
Q&A,
as you see fit.
JazakAllah khair. Before we take any questions and answers, can I give one final reminder for the human appeal? I mean, you've got the forms in front of you, and your donations will make a difference. Once you've completed it, you can bring it back. There'll be a brother standing by the door. If not, you can just leave it where we are, and we'll collect it at the end. Thank you. All right, so do you have any questions?
Questions, comments, or contentions? Yes, sir.
You're saying that you do agree that Sharia is needed in the modern world, and I would agree with you also. But I would disagree with you on one issue. I don't think the problem is Sharia law. There's a famous Arabic historian, he's actually left my mind, but he actually said, whenever Islam got into itself, into a cul-de-sac, they would produce scholars that would get them out of the problem. The problem, as I see for them, you mentioned Al-Ghazali, who wrote The Incoherence of Incoherence. And basically, he wrote a book using the philosophical elements of these philosophers to argue against their incomparable understanding of God. He actually used their own philosophical elements. What I'm trying to say is, I believe that our problem isn't the Sharia, that we're not producing the scholars that are required to guide us out of our problems. Because in Islam, we look at the scholars as the mountains, they're our guides. And unfortunately, we're living in a time where the scholars are ulama of Sultan instead of ulama of Quran. And I think the problem isn't Sharia at all. I think it's actual the fuqaha and the muftis. I don't think they're of the necessary ability to lead us through where we're going. And this is the problem. Many of us Muslims, when we're discussing things, we like to throw these scholars out as Al-Ghazali because they write these books. But unfortunately, many Muslims don't understand that the scholars who wrote those books had problems in their time, which are not problems of the 20th and 21st century. And my question to you is, if, as you said, the Sharia is a modern time, how can we produce these scholars to guide us through our problems in the 20th and 21st century?
Okay, so the gentleman said, times gone by, the Muslim civilization produce scholars to get themselves out of any particular problems they encountered, whereas today that's not happening, because if that was the case, we'd be out of these problems. Well, I would actually in one way agree and in one way disagree. So the one way I would agree is that you're right, the scholars which are produced by the institutions that we have today, these institutions are usually under the control of post-colonial secular states in the Muslim world. And of course, being secular states, they don't want scholarship in Islamic political philosophy, Islamic economics. What they want is people to say the importance of prayer, the importance of fasting, the importance of individual zakah, but that's it. Recitations, make your recitation really great, really beautiful, excellent, but that's it. Actually doing the meaning of these verses, or following the meaning of it, they don't want that, generally. I generalize here, and I kind of make an allegory out of it, but it's pretty much the case. This comes from the time of British colonialism, as well as French colonialism, which controlled the institutions that produced scholars in our countries. Certain curriculums were... Well, firstly, these institutions were basically had their funding cut unless they provided certain curriculums which were agreeable, and it led to the idea that, obviously, the poor had to rely on independent madrasas to teach them. But of course, because they weren't so well funded or didn't have access to teaching or to the libraries, central libraries, it developed the idea that those in the madrasa systems are ignorant of the world, because they were an attempt to create an independent education system without any funding or resources which a centralized state could provide, or any kind of government could provide, as used to happen in the past. So that's one thing I agree with you on. But I would also disagree with you because, okay, if we was to take, let's say, people usually say, if only there was a Salahuddin in this time. You know, people always say, if only there was a Salahuddin in this time, or if only the Mahdi came back and revived the Muslims and so on and so forth. I say, well, if Salahuddin came back now, or the Mahdi come out now, They'd be arrested for, as extremists, sent to jail, either executed quietly or just languish there forever. And none of you would be able to get them out. So, and that's what would happen in the Muslim world today. You could talk about Salahuddin, but guess what? Salahuddin only has power if people follow him. And even in his time, not everyone was following him as well, because Muslims were divided. But he united those, the Muslims. Whereas if the Mahdi, I always say, if the Mahdi came today, he'd be called an extremist, arrested, locked up, or exiled somewhere else. And that's what would probably happen today. See, you have to have society receptive to honor these individuals and to give them the right place. See, generally speaking, the Muslim world currently is not a meritocracy. Right? People who are the best talent, who are sincere, who desire to revive the Muslim world, are viewed as inconvenient to the ruling powers. And you know what's happened to them. They either go to jail, they have to leave, or they're under house arrest, or they're restricted, or a whole number of things. They're demonized, or there's the propaganda goes into action, and they are viewed as ignoramuses or as troublemakers in that society. And those who believe it are most of us. So there could be individuals, and I would say there are individuals of amazing talent right now, and most of you will never hear about them, know about them, or you will know about them but think they're ignorant or bad or wrong, because it is a problem of the jahili of the Muslim mindset now. You know they say a workman is only as good as his tools. Yeah, well the Mahdi or Salahuddin is only as good as the people around them. And if the people around them aren't very good, or are not willing, are not thinkers, or not people who think critically, or who are independent-minded to the extent that they basically want to excel, want to develop the Muslim world, then these leaders can't do anything. Look at the people they have to work with. So I would say that, well, that's where I would disagree, in the sense that there are some really great individuals, and the Ummah will always produce great scholars, great leaders. But currently now, these people, the Ummah are not ready to follow these people or find these people or even know of these people. They're more willing to believe. Let's take, for example, Egypt. I always bring Egypt as a great example. No one's saying that Muhammad al-Mursi was a genius or a great reviver or revivalist. No one needs to say that. But at the very least, everyone usually concedes that he was much less dictatorial than Mubarak. For example, people could insult him and deride him, which they did on media, and so on and so forth. And he didn't pursue his powers. He wanted to actually have an Egypt, which was unlike Mubarak's Egypt. Right? That was what they're trying to do. But guess what? What they call the Falul, the old guard, didn't like his guy. So they put the propaganda on the media into the full cycle, and it just caused numerous issues for Morsi. So basically, if he wasn't, he couldn't put any of the police who had shot protesters into jail, because the judges and the 3,000 judges and court system, what have you, were from the old school, the old guard. So they didn't want to do that. Then the people were inside against him, said, look, he's not bringing any of these police that killed or soldiers that killed protesters to justice, because look at him, he's not doing anything. So he's not a good leader. He's unjust. Look, he doesn't really care. He promised that he would bring Mubarak's men to justice. He hasn't done it. So he had to say, all right, well, to do this, I'm going to have to replace the judges, because they're not. These are the guys who are the obstacles to this. And as soon as he did that, the media said, look, he's trying to replace the judges and take control of the judiciary. There was nothing he could do to win. Nothing that he'd do that he wouldn't be attacked, demonized, and that the majority of the people in Egypt would believe it. They believed it. Majority believed it, went along with that. So you tell me what the difference would make of a great leader, a great scholar would do, or Salahuddin, or even the Mahdi would do in that society. Wouldn't do anything. Because he'd get arrested, locked up, demonized, what have you. The same. Not saying Morsi's comparable. I'm saying that Morsi is certainly better than Mubarak, but look what happened to him. So that's why I would disagree with you in that sense. And that's why, as Muslims, I think that we should... The biggest enemy of Muslims is Jahiliya, the ignorant mindset. In a way, Jahiliya is Muslim version of anarchy. Because anarchy, true anarchy doesn't exist. There's always going to be power structures. If there's no government, there'll be gangs that form, tribes that form. You know, humans will naturally fall into hierarchy. True anarchy is a society that doesn't have any higher values over itself. It's not united by any other higher concerns than individual self-interest benefit and competition. In that society, everyone's out for their own families or their own groups. Then there's no higher value than survival. And that, if anyone has gone to the Muslim world, is very much, I would say, it very much is what I've observed in those societies. It, you know, no one queues for shops or what have you, because queuing it happens in a society where people are comped in the system. That if you follow the rules, you'll get your interests. You'll get your interests fulfilled. Whereas in a society that doesn't have any higher values than just survival, self-interest, everyone's all jostling to get to the shops and all nudging each other out of the way. And you can even see it when in the Hajj, in how unfortunately, how when people come together, it's all this jostling and pushing and shoving and kicking and all this horrific stuff's happening at the place you think would be the least place that would happen. Our ancestors, if they saw this, they saw the Hajj today, they'd be aghast. Completely aghast. Now, it doesn't mean every country is exactly the same, of course. There's different countries. Muslim world is a big mosaic of different cultures, but this is what I've observed quite a lot. So the jahiliyyah is the biggest problem. The mindset whereby Muslims don't have any higher purpose other than just to survive and exist. And Islam is taught to Muslims as a checklist of just things you do and don't do. That's it. Just a checklist. So you're born in this life, survive, make your family proud of you, and if you can, don't break these rules. But if necessity compels you to, well, it's okay then. Yeah? Everyone, you know what the thing is? The idea of maslaha is, in the Muslim world, the idea of self-interest being used to abrogate parts of the Sharia is used in a way that our ancestors would never condone or recognize, and it just becomes pure whim in that sense. Maslaha, the idea of self-interest, what was the benefit of the society, was always viewed as whatever benefits Islam. Whatever benefits the Islamic world project to bring peace and justice and mercy to mankind. That's what was maslaha. But now we view maslaha as what is materially beneficial to the individual. Or what is more convenient. The idea of maslaha, today, is completely different to the understanding that our ancestors had. These are the issues that we have to deal with to resolve these problems. Because brothers and sisters, as Muslims, we're meant to be witnesses to mankind. That's where we should be at. Climate change, poverty in the third world, in South America, and this is where Muslims should be concerned at. This is where we should have been. Protecting the Native Americans, or the Aborigines, or those or minorities when the Rwandan massacres were happening. Muslims should have been right in there at the very beginning, protecting the Hutus and the Tutsis. That's where the Muslims, the Ummah of Muhammad should have been at the cutting edge of justice and mercy in mankind. Right now, we can't even do it in our own backyard. This is what I call, we're not even cognizant of the Islamic world project. Islam actually came to transform the world, and currently we're being transformed by it. And what's worse, we view being transformed by the world as wisdom, as hikmah. Oh, Islam's adaptive. It's very adaptive. It can adapt to any circumstance by changing itself. What was the point of that then? You know what was funny, subhanAllah, our end of this? I saw this article online. It was written by someone who I'd call it a modernist, who talked about Islam can change any time and place, can adapt to whatever the values and culture, the values and the morals and the way of doing things in any particular society, any place and time. And this non-Muslim guy wrote in the comment section, was a remarkably insightful comment, said, well, if Islam just adapts and changes itself to be like a chameleon at any culture, society, way of doing things, what's the point of it? What was the point of that then? Exactly. What is the point of it then? If Islam just changes itself like a chameleon. No, Islam came to change the colour of the world, not to be changed by it. Anyone at the back? No? Okay. Someone had an idea. Okay, you come back in a second. You, sir.
Yeah, I have two questions. The first one is that, as you mentioned in the beginning, that humans and human needs don't change with time. So why did God send 124,000 prophets with the different laws, although slightly different, but different laws with the time? And my second question is that, as you said, that as per Islam, there are finite economic needs of a person, but there are infinite desires. So in Islam, there's a belief that you should sacrifice on your desires for, like, the good of others. But how would you convince non-believers for that? Because they themselves would say that we are good with this capitalistic system and thus the interest and all these things. So doesn't it all boil down to the belief itself?
Okay, well, I would agree that as Muslims, generally, I was actually giving a talk on the Islamic economic system, and it was a non-Muslim audience who asked me the question, can non-Muslims implement it? Because it sounds like a good idea, so can non-Muslims do it? So, well, you can, but where will you find the motivation to do it? Because, for example, the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam taught about you can't hoard wealth, right? So as Muslims, if you give in charity, if you invest, if you spend, then have faith in Allah, that Allah, tawakkul in Allah, that Allah will give you that money back. But if you don't believe that, if you don't believe that promise, then how would you do that? And of course, you know that in a society where everyone's investing, everyone's in, spending, or everyone's giving in charity, all the money that was distributed in the previous day will go back into the market the next day, creating a constantly dynamic system, which a materialist might call artificial consumer confidence. Right, creating an artificial consumer confidence. Well, it's not artificial, it's faith-based consumer confidence, if you want to call it like that, although I wouldn't derogatively call human beings consumers. So you're right, it takes belief in Islam to implement these things, but here's the thing. Non-Muslims, in exchanging goods or trading with a Muslim civilization, could be enlightened by us, could actually be heartened and inspired by the Muslims. We know that humans are very good at conforming themselves to any society they grew up in. Right? Many, you know, you've heard atheists say, I'm a good guy, I believe, I have morals and so on and so forth, I don't need religion. Well, actually, you kind of needed your parents to teach you those things and to discipline you and society to teach you those things, and you just imitated your society, which ultimately came from a Christian background. But you need imitation, social imitation. So for non-Muslims, the issue would be is that if they saw a better way, if we inspired them with a better way, they would embrace it. And in many cases, even embrace Islam. What's the world's biggest or largest Muslim country in terms of population? Anyone?
Indonesia.
Indonesia, Malaysia. The largest Muslim populations in the world. Well, Indonesia anyway, but Malaysia, if you add it all together, if you take away the colonialism from the colonial borders, the Malays, right? Largest Muslim population in the world in one area. Well, guess what? There was no forced conversions of Islam upon them. There was no armies that came to their countries or invaded or what, any of that stuff. They converted to Islam purely from contact with Muslim merchants and traders. They saw the justice of Islam in the Muslim economic system and the trading and so on, how it didn't want to exploit people. It didn't come to suck their resources dry or give them a bad deal, but engaged in equitable trading with them and kept their word and kept the bond and desired not just material profit, but actually the reward with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That inspired the Malays to become Muslim. Understand? So that's how, as Muslims, we should be approaching this matter. So we should, don't be too concerned with non-Muslims being inspired to adhere to an Islamic system. We're meant to be the example of justice. And if we inspire them, then they will adopt that example, and maybe they'll choose to adopt Islam as well. Currently, we are far from the example of justice. So I often say, and I make this point, that we might view that the means of bringing people to Islam is through dawah, invitation, someone deliberately inviting or da'is. It's not. Historically, that wasn't what converted the vast majority of people to Islam. It was the example of the Islamic civilization. It's actual example that converted them. That converted them by the hundreds of thousands. Not one Ahmadi, that type of guy that gave great debates and everyone became Muslim. No. So it was all of us, our collective example. And that is where we have to be at. And so on, going ahead. Anyone else has questions, comments, or contentions? Have I cowed you into silence? Anyone? Going once? Going twice?
All right.
Right, okay, inshallah.
Thank you everyone once again to Dr. Khair for this enlightening talk. And this basically concludes our week of lectures. I hope this has been beneficial to all of you.